Thanks very much, Paul, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to give a macroeconomic view of what I think the outlook is. I'm a macroeconomist. I have been for 30 years working in the City of London in various guises, as was indicated, and hopefully that will provide an introduction and possibly a counterpoint for Peter to actually talk about asset allocation, markets and things of that sort, and hopefully we're specialising very much according to our comparative advantage. I'm going to talk about the credit crunch and what impact it's likely to have upon economic activity. I'm going to talk about the outlook for economic activity per se, though, because I don't think the credit crunch is by any means the only influence upon what's happening at the moment and what's going to happen subsequently. And I'm also going to focus upon a number of important implications and a number of important issues which are currently preoccupying the financial markets. One is what sort of policy response is likely. And I think that comes under the heading of interest rates and fiscal policy. Secondly, I'm going to talk about the inflation outlook, whether or not there is the risk of stagflation, whether inflation is a clear and present danger, and I think I'm going to be somewhat controversial in that regard. And finally, I'm just going to talk a little bit about company profits, how they've been behaving over the course of the last few decades, and whether there is in fact a structural shift underway, or whether we can expect a great deal of disappointment going ahead. And hopefully, as I say, that will knit nicely into the sort of things which Peter will be talking about. As for the question of whether any early end to the credit crunch is in sight, I think people are becoming progressively disillusioned. When the credit crunch first hit with full impact back last summer, I think an awful lot of people hoped, at least, that it would be over by Christmas, but of course it wasn't. And all the most recent indicators suggest things are getting worse rather than better. Certainly that's the case of credit market indicators and spreads and things of that sort, which we've all become accustomed to reading about so copiously in the newspapers over the course of the last 6 months or so. But I think also investors have yet to be fully reassured that all the bad news is yet out in the open. Investors aren't yet convinced that banks have fully recognised all the balance sheet damage which is going to be wrought by these bad debts, and I think they're braced for worse news to come. Just as importantly, central bank surveys of bank lending attitudes suggest that banks are getting increasingly cautious, but history suggests that there's probably much further to go. Banks, of course, became exceedingly lax in their lending standards, both in the United States and elsewhere in the world, notably Europe, over the course of the last few years, and I think there is now a significant retrenchment underway which has further to run. And finally, and perhaps the most important point, is that the US housing market, as far as I can see, shows no signs yet of stabilisation. It was an interesting development last year. In the first half of last year, many people, particularly in America, thought that what we were seeing was a very short-lived adjustment, that the housing market was simply slowing rather than actually deflating, and that the second half of the year would be better. The Federal Reserve appeared to share this view too. In the second half of the year, though, I think reality actually dawned and people realised that what they were seeing was something quite big, and that, I think, is the case now. I certainly think that what happened in the US housing market in the 10 years or so up to 2005 was a financial bubble, nothing more, nothing less, and parallel with financial bubbles throughout history, starting with Dutch tulips. Basically, people thought the prices were going to go up forever, liquidity was abundant, interest rates were low, and multiples, if you like, valuation multiples, got exceedingly stretched. But there was massive denial about this, and two economists at the New York Fed back in 2005 actually wrote a paper seeking to demonstrate that there was no bubble. I think they would actually take a rather different view now. In fact, one of them was said to have been heard saying about 6 months ago, "I wish I'd never written that paper, but they made me do it," which seems a rather odd way to actually get out of the responsibility. But I can myself recall being told about a year and a half ago by the chief economist of Countrywide, which was at the time the biggest US lender, that there was no bubble and that basically the US housing market could only keep improving. I don't know whether that guy still has a job, but if he has, I suspect he's very shamefaced. But basically, when you look at the most recent data, and we do get a fresh welter of it month after month, I can't see that any end is yet in sight. If you look at things like existing home sales and new home sales, they continue to fall. When you look at measures of inventory, they continue to rise. Clearly a massive overhang there. And of course, house price deflation is actually accelerating month by month. And history does suggest that housing price bubbles, once they begin to burst and begin to deflate, do take several years to actually adjust. You don't just have to look at Japan from early 90s onwards to reach that conclusion. You can look at the UK in the early 90s, you can look at Scandinavia in the late 80s and the early 90s, and you can look even further back. I think what we're seeing now is a multi-year adjustment. And although at the moment people are saying the second half of this year is going to be better than the first, I'm rather sceptical of that. I think things are going to continue to deteriorate throughout this year. But the basic point is, if the housing market doesn't stabilise, I don't see how the subprime crisis can actually improve. I can't see how the credit situation can actually stabilise. And of course, if we're moving into a period in which the US economy perhaps is going into recession, then worries about household debt and corporate credit in particular can only intensify. So I don't want to depress people unduly, but I really do think things are going to get a lot worse. Now, this leads on to the question of how sharp and prolonged any economic slowdown is going to be, whether in the US or elsewhere. I think it's fair to say that over the last few months, economists have been gradually pulling in their horns as far as their forecasts for this year has been concerned. If you look at any survey of consensus, The Economist magazine publishes one once a month, Consensus Economics does another, you'll see that forecasts for 2008 GDP numbers in the US, in the Eurozone, in the UK and in Japan and elsewhere have been gradually edging downwards. And the reason they've been edging downwards, of course, is that growth has been disappointing. If you look at actually how economic surprises have come in, particularly in the United States, they have been severely disappointing. People have been taken aback by how fast things have deteriorated. My own view is that economists, the economic consensus, if you like, has yet to fully take account of what is really going on. And I think these consensus forecasts will keep falling in coming months. I also noticed that company analysts' earnings upgrades and downgrades also appear to be moving downwards, which would exactly what you'd expect in this sort of environment. And suggesting that things are going to get worse before they get better, JP Morgan actually put together a global PMI each month. It comprises the US ISM survey, which the markets have always watched very closely, but also other surveys, PMI surveys around the world, which the markets have only begun to watch closely in the last few years. And in January, this actually fell to its lowest level since April 2003, with service sector activity particularly weak. This PMI is a fairly good leading indicator of activity, albeit with a fairly short lead, so that suggests things are going to get worse. And also leading indicators of activity worldwide, such as those published by the OECD, the Conference Board in America, the Belgian Central Bank, the Japanese Cabinet Office, they're all pointing downwards at the moment and pointing to much worse news to come. Now, the debate as whether the US is actually in recession or about to enter recession continues. Most economists don't think the US is going to see a recession, but I would be rather cynical and say that most economists never see a US recession coming, and they usually don't acknowledge it until it's well underway. But I did think it significant that the monthly blue chip consensus survey in the United States, although the majority of economists still saw no recession, thought the odds of a recession this month were actually almost 50%. That's a very high number, and for the majority of US economists to accept that there's a half-in-half chance of recession suggests that people are really wavering. My own view is that there is going to be a recession. I'm not sure it started yet. If you look at various indicators, it's not ambiguous, it's not unambiguous, it's not quite clear whether the economy has yet fallen off the cliff, but I do think that over coming months it's going to be increasingly clear that the US economy has begun to contract. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. One of them is the housing market. The housing market is a significant part of US economic activity. Residential activity has been contracting now for the last 18 months. I don't see why that should change in coming quarters. And also, there will be knock-on effects upon the consumer from the housing market through adverse wealth effects. And these adverse wealth effects will be compounded if, of course, the equity market continues to do badly as well. But what I find particularly worrisome about the current situation is what's happening to corporate profits in America. I think one of the best kept secrets at the moment is that whole economy profit measures in the United States, which are usually a much better measure of underlying profits growth than the S&Ps, the S&P profits, which analysts and the markets concentrate upon, whole economy profits measures have been in recession now for the last year. Non-financial profits have been falling year on year since Q4 2006. We haven't yet got the Q4 data. We'll get that at the end of March. It takes quite a long time for the statistician to put this together, but I'm very confident that this profits recession will have continued. And to my book, if profits actually deteriorate, they usually take investment and employment with them. Now, it's a very old tenet of classical business cycle theory, first put forward by Wesley Mitchell in the 1930s, that profits are a key driving force of the business cycle. And it's always puzzled me why more economists don't actually focus upon profits, but they often don't get a mention. But I think the fact that whole economy profits are already in recession helps explain why capital investment in the US has slowed down so sharply over the last year. It helps explain why employment growth has slowed so sharply as well. And it also helps explain why measures of consumer confidence, business confidence, have actually collapsed very, very sharply in conjunction with this. And if this profits recession continues, which I think it will do, then that will actually take the economy, I think, into recession territory. There is one final point worth making in connection with the credit crunch, though. Many people seem to believe that the US corporate sector is actually in surplus, that it's cash rich, and they point to lots of big companies in the S&P 500 as illustrative proof of that thesis. If you actually look at the quarterly flow of funds for the US economy, which the Federal Reserve puts together, you'll actually see that the non-financial sector was last year, in fact, in substantial deficit. And of course, until the credit crunch actually broke, it was relying primarily upon the corporate bond market to finance that deficit. I don't see any reason why that deficit will have gone away in the fourth quarter or in the current quarter. And on that basis, I think the credit crunch is likely to have quite an impact. In other words, the US corporate sector, because it's in deficit, because it's having to rely upon a substantial amount of external finance, it means that the credit crunch is really likely to hurt. And I think the way that will be reflected is in cutbacks in CapEx and employment. Now, I should just qualify that by saying that as yet, there's no indication that the jobs market is deteriorating very, very fast indeed. I think the best way to categorise the American jobs market is to say that hiring has slowed very, very sharply indeed over the course of the last 6 to 12 months, but the firing has not yet begun, except, of course, in the mortgage industry and to some degree in the financial service industry. But I think there's a very real likelihood that that's exactly what will happen. Unemployment, the labour market, is a lagging indicator, and if corporates are as proactive as they have been in previous downturns in protecting their margins, then I think it will be jobs which take the hit, and the consumer will therefore pull in their horns. I'm not saying there's going to be a big consumer recession, but I find it very difficult to see how consumer spending in the States is going to hold up, given what's happening to asset prices, and also given what is happening to the jobs market. Now, it's very interesting, but hope always springs eternal as far as economists are concerned. If you look at what economists are forecasting in any year, the year after that, they will generally forecast a return to trend. Every year it happens, and in January, for example, when people publish their forecasts for, the year after next, you always find that the majority of people are saying that growth will be back to trend, whatever happens in the interim. Now, people often ridicule this, but I think to some degree there is a justification, because in the absence of adverse shocks, whether it's an oil price hike, whether it's a boost to profits or whatever, in the absence of outright shocks, growth will revert to trend. That's very likely indeed. But the trouble is, of course, there are very rarely absent shocks. Something usually happens to actually divert growth. So I think when economists say that growth is going to be back at trend in 2009, that frankly is a pretty meaningless statement. But one thing I have thought was very significant about the last few weeks is the debate about what's going to happen in the US economy in the second half of the year. Ever since the US President and Congress agreed to put forward a stimulus package to try and basically save their skins ahead of the elections in this coming November, and ever since the Fed actually cut rates by 125 basis points in January, people have been arguing that this interest rate cut and this fiscal boost will actually lift economic activity in the second half of the year, and that will buoy the economy and will also buoy profits. And although people aren't particularly upbeat about S&P profits growth in Q1 and Q2, I think that analysts, or at least sell-side analysts, are currently saying that profits are going to grow at a rate of about 15% year-on-year in the second half of the year. I actually think both those prognoses, that there's going to be stronger growth in the second half of the year and that there'll be a strong bounce back in corporate profits, are likely to prove absolutely wrong. One way of looking at this is to think in terms of headwinds and tailwinds. There are two tailwinds in place. We have had interest rate cuts. The US government bond yield has fallen very sharply, and the dollar has weakened. This adds up to a very substantial monetary boost. And there are, of course, going to be tax cuts, although the degree to which they're going to be saved rather than spent is a subject for debate. Back in 2001, for instance, no more than 40% of the tax cuts were actually spent. The rest were actually saved or used to pay off debt. But nonetheless, against this, there are some very strong headwinds. There's the oil price, which is currently running at around $100 and shows no signs of going down. That is going to have a big impact upon costs and upon people's purchasing power. There's the housing market, which, as I indicated earlier, is still still deflating and showing no signs of turning around. And there's the equity market, which isn't exactly robust. And on top of that, there's the profits and the credit crunch, with banks increasingly unwilling to lend. My judgment of these factors means that the US economy is going to be in recession in the first half of the year. And even if it does see some sort of recovery in the second half of the year, any such recovery is going to be extremely limited. And I think we're going to have a very, very sluggish year indeed for the US economy. And I think there's a lot more disappointment in store. As for the rest of the world, I do think this idea that the rest of the world can effectively decouple for the US is likely to be put to the test this year, and I think it's likely to be found wanting. Traditionally, people think that when the US economy sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold, or at least a bad case of the sniffles, and that's actually been historically true. Now people argue that the US is less important than it was, and therefore a US recession needn't have that sort of effect. I simply don't buy that. I'm fairly old-fashioned, but I also note that the US economy is still the world's largest economy. It's still the world's largest importer. And there are other factors, too, which are slowing growth elsewhere in the world, such as high oil prices. And I think the signs of slowdown, which are now becoming manifest both in Europe and Japan, are likely to persist. And I do think the idea of decoupling, particularly as far as the G7 is concerned, is going to bite the dirt this year. As far as the emerging markets are concerned, I don't think the situation is quite so serious, and there are some arguments which will actually help those economies decouple. One is that they do have room for fiscal stimulus, many of them, if they so wish, so they can actually pump up their domestic demand to keep their economies going. Another is that many of them are running effective dollar pegs, whether a fixed exchange rate, as in several Arab countries, or a much more informal exchange rate peg, as in Asia. And this means that they are intervening to hold down their exchange rates, and that flooding their economy with liquidity and keeping interest rates low. That's going to be a stimulus. And also in the case of China, we've observed that over the last 7 or 8 years, and particularly since China joined the WTO in 2001, when the US economy slowed, FDI investment into China has tended to increase. So if therefore the US economy is now slowing and continuing to slow, I would expect FDI investment to pick up. And that is a powerful motor of growth in the Chinese economy. But overall, I think if the US does indeed go into recession, the rest of the world will not be immune. There will be trade effects which are adverse, there will be financial effects which are adverse, and I think that as the IMF, which appears to over the last year have changed its mind on this matter, I think many investors will realise that they have been pursuing something of a pipe dream, and that the world, an increasingly globalised world, is still very, very dependent upon the US economy. Now, just in terms of the likely policy response, we've had a big policy response already, I must confess. I mean, I always think in terms of surprises, because the job of an analyst in the financial markets, if you like, is to think in terms of surprises. What's going to take people aback? What haven't they actually taken account of? And I freely confess that I didn't expect the Fed to be so aggressive in easing monetary policy in January, and nor did I expect the President and Congress to quite so easily cobble together a fiscal package. I thought that party competition ahead of the elections would actually outweigh cooperation. But clearly I underestimated that. Obviously, we've had the fiscal surprise. There's not going to be another one. But I do think the Fed is going to keep cutting rates, and probably quite aggressively. I'm not convinced they're going to do another 75, but I think another 50 in March is certainly likely, and I think they will then keep on cutting. And I was asked about 6 weeks ago where I thought rates would actually bottom this year, and I said 2% in the US. I've since thought it might actually be lower than that. And don't forget, they did go almost to 1% in the early part of this century. And I think that what you have to bear in mind, and actually be reassured by, is that Ben Bernanke is well grounded in the economics of the Depression in the 1930s, and of course of what went wrong in Japan in the 1990s. And Ben Bernanke knows two things about the current situation. One is that the banking system must be kept afloat at all costs. That's exactly what wasn't done in the early 1930s in the United States. And secondly, he knows that deflation has to be headed off at all costs. And I'll come on to inflation and deflation in a moment, but I actually think the risk of deflation is far higher in the US economy than many people seem to think, and I think Bernanke probably thinks the same. And don't forget that it was Bernanke back in late 2002 that so surprised the world by making a speech whereby he said that the Fed would do everything it could to fight deflation, and laid out lots of unconventional policy measures which the Fed could adopt if they so wished to do that, quite apart from running interest rates down to almost zero. So I think in Bernanke, the States has a pretty safe pair of hands, but I do think people are going to be surprised, even given what the bond markets are currently pricing in, and they're pricing in quite a lot of ease already into what's actually going to happen over the course of the next 6 to 9 months. Finally, just about other central banks, the ECB, of course, is currently still making hawkish noises about interest rates. The Bank of England is rather grudgingly accepting that perhaps the economy is sliding more than they thought, but they're still worried about inflationary pressures, both in product and labour markets. I think that over the course of the next 6 to 9 months, those worries are going to disappear. Just as in the US, the Fed, back in the second half of last year, was still saying that the primary policy risk was inflation. They're not saying that anymore. I think the Bank of England and then the ECB will actually gradually accept that inflation is not a problem, and they will start moving rates downwards, and I think by more than the markets even now currently expect. And as for the Bank of Japan, of course, which has been itching to raise rates for the last 18 months, I think the likely surprise this year is that they actually cut them again, although of course they're currently actually very, very close to zero. Just finally, a couple of words about the inflation outlook and about corporate profits. And these are very much big picture topics, which don't really change month by month. At the moment, of course, there's a lot of anxiety that inflation is about to take off in the G7, whether in the US or the Eurozone or the UK. People are worried about wages. People are worried about commodity prices feeding through. I don't think it's going to have that much effect. If you look at history, you'll see that back in the late 60s and early 70s, of course, higher energy, sharply higher energy prices and food prices did in fact push up underlying inflation in the major economies. But this time round, there's very little sign that this is happening. Don't forget, the oil price has been spiking upwards for the last 4 or 5 years, and yet core inflation rates in the major economies remain reasonably well behaved. And I think that's going to continue to be the case. What I find particularly reassuring is that wage inflation in the major economies, whether in the UK and Japan, in the Eurozone or the US, is still very, very low compared to the level of unemployment. Unemployment is at a very low level, multi-year lows in many economies, and yet wage inflation is not picking up. Now, a sceptic would say, well, there's going to be a lag and wage inflation will pick up very sharply and everybody will be surprised. I don't think so. I think labour markets are very different animals now than they were in the 60s and 70s, and I think labour is very much on the back foot, and I'll be very surprised if wage inflation picks up. And as for product price inflation, I think that as economies slow, that will actually knock pricing power on the head. Companies will find it increasingly difficult to raise prices, and I think inflation fears will gradually dissipate. So although food price inflation and energy inflation are likely to remain on their scene for the time being, I don't think underlying inflation performance is going to deteriorate in the major economies, and I certainly don't think any tag of stagflation will be an appropriate way to describe the economic conjuncture during 2008. Just finally, corporate profits. Obviously, analysts, fund managers watch corporate profits very, very closely too, but so do economists. And what happens to profit share and labour share is a matter of enduring interest. One of my favourite books when I was actually a student of economics back in the 1970s was a book written by Andrew Glynn, a very talented Oxford economist who sadly died last year. Andrew Glynn wrote a book called British Capitalism, Workers and the Profit Squeeze, a very early 1970s title, where he argued that actually profits in the UK and elsewhere were being squeezed by the rising power of labour. Well, interestingly enough, ever since 1980, the boot, if you like, has been on the other foot, and it's labour which has been very much on the defensive. And Andrew actually wrote a book in 2006 called Capitalism Unleashed, which revisited this thesis and actually asked why it had actually turned quite so sharply over the course of the last 20 to 25 years. And other people have looked at this as well. And I think there have been various reasons. One is that governments have tended to be very, very pro-business, have gone increasingly anti-labour. It hasn't just been Margaret Thatcher in the early 80s, it's been government worldwide, and of course even the current Labour government has basically approved of the Margaret Thatcher labour market reforms. There has been lots of labour market deregulation. There's also been the massive globalisation, of course, which has brought labour suppliers from the emerging markets into competition with the West, which I think has been enormously powerful. And there's also been the advent of IT and its deployment in business for the last 20 to 25 years, which I think has an enormous effect upon raising labour productivity. But the profits of that have gone mainly to corporates rather than to the labour force. And you actually have a situation where the profit share over the last few years in the major economies has risen very, very sharply indeed, whether in the United States, whether in Germany, whether in Japan, whether in the UK. Now, in the near term, I do think profits are going to take a hit. I've said that about America already. America's already seeing a profits recession. I suspect that's going to be reflected elsewhere. It's beginning in Japan. I suspect it will begin in Europe and the UK over the course of the last year as well. But the key issue is whether some of the structural changes which have taken place over the last 20 years or so are going to remain in place, or whether cyclical factors will reassert themselves, and whether profits will, as some of my former colleagues used to assert, will in fact revert to mean, i.e. fall very, very sharply. I'm very sceptical of this, and I do think that profits are probably going to retain the higher ground. The only reasons I would worry would be if governments looked as if they were going to turn against capital and were going to actually move it on behalf of labour and shift the profit share in that direction. But at the moment, I can see no sign of that in the major economies. And I do think, actually, in the very near term, we're probably going to be surprised by how aggressive corporates are in defending their profits margins. And in the near term, of course, that's going to be bad for labour markets. But in the longer term, it's probably going to be good news because profits will then be restored. But as I say, on this key issue of company profits, whether the profit share is going to stay at a new historical high level structurally, I'd be an optimist rather than the pessimist. Although, as I say, I think there is going to be a near-term hit to profits and to people's expectations as a result of the economic slowdown which is currently underway, as a result of the US recession, which I think is materialising as we speak, and as a result of the ongoing credit crunch, of which I as yet at least see no end in sight. I'll finish there. I hope that's covered the ground adequately, and I also hope in particular it's provided a fertile starting point for Peter to talk about markets. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're not really here to cheer you up, I guess. If you thought I was going to come here and give you an opinion as to whether the stock market is going to go up or down in the next few weeks, I'm not going to do that. So if you wanted cheering up and to know what the stock market's going to do in the short run, I would suggest you make your way to the public house that's been mentioned and don't stay here and listen to me. However, what I'm trying to try and do is to look at a longer perspective as to what's happened, as I see it, to the way we run our portfolios. By we, I'm generally referring to the pension funds and insurance companies, the so-called professional investors that often call upon the services of actuaries and portfolio managers, and with perhaps a little mention of private investors and possibly even some of the state wealth funds and so on as we go along. But basically, the way portfolios are run by what we nicely call institutional investors. Yeah, good. It's working. Firstly, I think that we need to strike a balance, and to some extent we've lost this balance, between a dependence upon analysis, statistics, forecasts, all wonderful stuff, on the one hand, and the fact that markets, not just the equity market, any market where there are buyers and sellers, which is most markets, I think, by definition, greed, fear, very human attributes are at work. And I see this all the time, and I see actually not a lot of acknowledgement of it. So on the one hand, we've all got to do a lot of analysis. We've got to be clever. Perhaps we even have to have large spreadsheets, though I think there is a sort of side effect to this is that there is an overweight. There is probably far too much data to such that often the data is actually standing in the way of good decisions as far as investors and their advisors are concerned. But on the other hand, I think we have to understand that these very bright people, with all their data, information, and analytic capability, can do some horrendously stupid things. So, what I'm going to do. Firstly, the origins of today's problems, as I see it, what's gone on today, and I'm not just talking about the last year or two. What will the industry do? Few guesses there. What ought the industry to do? You've probably gathered so far that they're probably not the same thing in my mind. I think there are some areas where they cross over. And then a little bit about the little fund that Fidelity allowed me to set up, a sort of toy thing, you know, to keep the old soul happy. And it gives me a little credibility within the organisation because I do tend to write notes and have meetings and things, and it makes a lot of sense if you've actually got a bit of money where the performance is measured rather than just spend your time telling people where they got it wrong. Right. Been around a long time, and frankly, the last couple of years and the next couple of years will in due course be but the twinkling of an eye in market terms, I'm sure about that. It's lovely to see a long-term market of this. This is 1975. It's in a sense, the bull market. I mean, I don't quite know how you define bull and bear markets, but the equity bull market, in my view, probably started about the 1970s and continued up arguably to today, or perhaps you might say it stopped when that chart stops about 2000. What was happening then? Well, I mean, the world has changed radically. I have seen today's environment likened to the 1970s. Well, no one who was there would do that. I mean, that is like telling someone who nearly died on the Titanic that they better stay off the pond in their village if the weather gets bad. We're in a very different climate today than we were then. Perhaps the most obvious thing that's happened, though, is the inflation rate. That we have today a much lower inflation rate than there was then. This has allowed bond rates, interest rates to come down, the price-earnings ratio of the markets to go up. I'm talking about the Western markets here. It's been a wonderful, wonderful climate. And if I've got a big question mark, it is that it? You know, has it finished or has it not finished? And one thing that worries me, and I wouldn't want to take issue with Ian particularly in the short run, but I sense that perhaps this wonderful climate of falling inflation, which has driven ratings up, may be coming to an end, which is not to say that inflation is a problem, that it's going to go shooting upwards and become a big policy issue. But nonetheless, I'm very interested in trends and change and whether things are getting better or worse. And it seems to me that the background was improving, and today it's probably not improving, albeit not deteriorating very much. What happened during this time? I remember when I started back in the early 70s, there was a panic on shortly after I started, towards the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, to buy property. The pension funds, I worked for a fund manager who managed pension funds, not Fidelity back then, were desperate for it. They were desperate for it. They'd worked out this was what they needed. And the surveyors and the people they appointed were desperate to buy the property so the guys could raise the property weighting in their portfolios. By the time we got to the year of grace 2000, a lot of these guys had sold out. They had all bought into the equity story. Equities were, with a few exceptions, very, very high proportion of their portfolios. They had great reasons for this. You know, they analyzed the past performance and so on, risks and returns and volatilities, and they seemed that they were doing the right thing. Bonds were for wimps. The world had apparently changed, and they didn't want to know. Other things had happened within portfolios. Benchmarking became the norm. If the market always goes up, then clearly the big risk becomes not getting that action, doesn't it? It's obvious. Outperforming cash becomes pathetic, you know, when you have an equity market like that. Another thing that I notice, which concerns me a very great deal, is that people like ourselves and our clients and the people advise us, I think have largely, and I think this applies today just as much as it did in the year 2000, have lost a sense of ownership of the asset that's actually providing the return to us. In other words, I think people have tended to look at vehicles, products, growth rates, risk return, and forget that if you own an equity, presumably the reason you own it is that you think the companies are going over time to pay you some money. How much money comes, of course, pretty critical. And I think a lot of that has got lost. And of course, if you put a derivative in front of someone, they may well be inclined to forget what it is that's the underlying engine, as I tend to call it. Timescales definitely contracted. Definitely contracted. If you'd taken the people who were running the money when I started and put them in today's market, they would just be bowled over by the turnover, the discussion of what's happening right today, the obsession. Though, of course, there have always been crises and people do get very short-term and very obsessed. But even in the good times, incredible obsession with what's going on right at the moment. In the good times, say the TMT technology bull market, you know, the new products and so on, and forgetting the fact that, again, why would you give anyone any money if you didn't expect to get it back? I think also probably investors and their advisors and clients are probably have become overconfident. Now, right at the moment, I think the confidence is low, but I mean, this certainly was the case. People were rather taking for granted that the good times were here and were likely to stay. Very different environment. And now, what I would say is that those changes were not rational, sensible, logical changes, but they were a reaction to the markets. That's what happened. People were used to making money, so the guards come down and they make assumptions and they get slack. This is the markets after that period. Actually, a lot of the major markets just about halved in price, and you won't need me to tell you that people were pretty cautious at the bottom there, and somewhat less cautious at the two high points. And at the moment, they've got pretty cautious. Again, message here, for a long-term fund, you know, why are we sort of so bothered? Should we not be looking more at the actual assets that we own rather than these movements? Okay, a little bit more now about what's happened right now. A little bit on subprime and credit and so on. Here was a great example, forgetting equities for a moment now, where the bond people lost sight of the engine. It seems very strange that you can take a bunch of dodgy loans and package it up so that a large proportion of it comes out as sort of AAA bonds or AA bonds or whatever. But it seems that if you sort of suspend judgment, it's possible, or it was. But I would argue that this is not so much a statistical problem as forgetting the engine. Where's the cash going to come from that's going to pay you the interest that you're going to get on your subprime vehicle, pay your friendly investment banker the fees which he most assuredly will be charging you when you buy this paper? Where's that cash coming from? And then if we said, well, this is actually what, you know, used to be called junk paper, you sort of start to wonder whether it's very sensible. But people forgot that. The back testing. Amazing. Some of you may have read about the LTCM, the long-term credit management. When I sort of looked into this long after the event, this was an organization that was brought to its knees because it bet upon the relationship between different bonds and other asset classes, and the relationships broke up, and they increased the bets, and it basically destroyed them. But when I read this, I was very surprised, because I could remember times when the relationships which they were betting against did not hold, so which they were betting in favor of, did not hold. So why would they bet the ship on relationships which had held recently but had not held in the past before that? Answer was, they took a look and decided the environment was different. So they didn't need to take account of the contrary evidence at all, because the world had changed. And this was very strange, because you had very intelligent people making a really dumb judgment, which is that it makes sense to back the relationships of the last 5 years or 7 years or whatever in their infinite wisdom they decided was the correct period. Yes. Sort of direct cable from God, I suppose, saying, you know, take 7 years, guys, that's the right period to work your numbers out on. But yet, if you look back further, you would never have done what they did. Perhaps they were just given too much money by their clients, I don't know. Same thing with subprime. If you took the very low rate of losses that was the case, unsurprisingly, when monetary policy had been as easy as it was, of course nobody's going to lose any money, because there's always some other idiot will lend them some more money to pay the interest off the first loan. I mean, you don't lose money when it's as freely available as it was then. But had you looked back further and just assumed a return to what had been perfectly normal rate of mortgage losses not that long ago, you would have seen there was a big problem. Poor old investors, dear oh dear, a lot of them I think were just confused by the complexity. I mean, if the banks couldn't understand what their liability was, what chance has a sort of Landesbank in Germany got of understanding what on earth this piece of paper is they bought? What they knew, of course, was that it said AA on the label, so it must have been all right. The other, I think, thing which is really interesting is there is an argument which says that if we take a really risky piece of paper, a load of risky pieces of paper, put them all together, flog them off to a whole range of people, then we have dissipated the risk. Now, that's quite right. You have dissipated the risk. But, of course, the same risk is in the system. It just holds in different hands than previously. So, if you like, what you may do is cause a very large number of nasty but not terminal hits to the banking system, investors and so on, rather than in the old days where you probably blew up completely a smaller number of organisations. I think that's actually a risk to the economy, is that there's so many entities out there who've lost money here. And if you haven't got capital, you can't go out and do stuff. So was it economic or behavioural what's happened? Well, I would say, firstly, in the banking sector, there were huge behavioural incentive issues. If you are paid to sell loans rather than lend money, if that's your way of looking at it, you get a fee for selling a loan. What in the old days a banker would have called lending people money, then you're going to sell loans. We all work like that. In the old days, of course, a banker would have been paid well if he made some loans and got the money back. In the new world, probably they'd all left before they counted up to see what was going to happen. So I would say there's a huge behavioural issue there, and fee-driven, bonus-driven, and so on. The rating agencies, come on. If you have a client, or those of you who are involved in it, who wants to appoint a pension fund manager, and we get a consultant along, not, I'm sure, anyone in this room, who said, fidelity are the people, you've got to have fidelity, and it turns out they're paid by fidelity, I think you would sort of look again. Well, the investors didn't pay the rating agencies. We have again this issue about just looking back in the short term, assessing risk based on recent experience. Anyone who looked at the losses to different types of loans could see that the experience of the last sort of 5-7 years was unusually low losses. In UK, some of the banks were making no provisions against their mortgage loans. Now, you know, they must have been pretty good at making mortgage loans, I would have thought. And certainly all history would suggest they are the first bankers who managed to make mortgage loans where nothing goes wrong, you know, so that's pretty good. Some of those people are now employed by Her Majesty. The great fee conspiracy. Now, nasty this. A bit close to home for all of us. Fees do change behaviour. And one of the problems within the financial system today is that in our desire to find clever vehicles, we are continually being forced to pay fees to intermediaries to put together these vehicles, when in a low inflation, low interest rate environment, and even with my sense that inflation a little bit less relaxed than Ian about inflation, we're not talking about high inflation, we're only going to get 8% return off, say, equity, something like that. How are we going to fund the damn fees? Answer is, I'm not buying anything where we're paying a lot of fees. You know, are you? Yes, I put down here some sort of back of the envelope returns if you buy these things today. 7 or 8% from equities. That's just the dividend and the growth rate added up, long-term return. We haven't got a lot of cash there to pay fees. Another thing, though, which has concerned me, more both as a sort of manager but also as looking at these asset issues, is what I've called here the benchmarking cancer. Now, benchmarks change the behaviour of fund managers. I suspect they also change the behaviour of fund managers, consultants, and clients. It seemed to me, back in the old days, it was a pretty good idea to see how we were doing. So in that sense, you probably need a benchmark to see how it does and see how you do in relation to it. You know, that's a very sensible thing to do. But what I certainly know and have experienced is the fact that as soon as you slap in benchmarks, you change fund managers' behavior. Now, you probably didn't intend to do that. But believe you me, it's a very important determinant of how your managers will behave. Firstly, incentives again, psychology. Outperforming the benchmark, it becomes what everybody wants to do. That's the game, isn't it? I mean, it's the game, really. Now, my friends back in the 1970s would have just sort of laughed all the way to the pub, whose name I've forgotten, if you said that the object was to outperform the benchmark by 2%. I showed you the chart of the market halving in price. You know, say, well, we did 2% better than that, you know, so come on, where's my performance fee? Well, I think that's a bullet through the head, isn't it, they want, not a performance fee. And that was certainly understood and appears to have been forgotten. I suspect some of the clients have actually worked it out. Timescale shrink. What's the benchmark doing today? Daily performance numbers, hourly performance numbers, moment performance numbers. Vodafone, over 10% of the index it was. Jesus, the pain for someone who didn't have Vodafone and saw it go up 0.5%, you know, to work out the basis points lost, have to go to the toilet after that. I mean, it changes behavior. We can't take the pain of not owning it. Losing money, as I said, becomes pretty irrelevant to us. The economic driver completely goes out of the window because, let's face it, why should you own a good company that's going to pay a lot of cash out to its investors when there's a bad company going to go up more? If you're benchmarking, I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. You buy the bad company, obviously. Managers do become obsessed with the big bets, and you sort of probably heard investment managers pontificate. We love to pontificate as part of the job. Pontificating on about, you know, if you get BP wrong, Jesus, that's pretty bad. You get BP wrong, or get BP and Shell wrong, oh dear. And it's driving the behavior of your fund manager. You don't need me to tell you that if you're a pension fund, source of intense amusement to me, you change the way you measure the liability, you change the behavior of the pension funds the next day. Oh my God, they change the bonds we're using. Jesus, we'll have to sell that lot and buy this lot. Now, my proposal is that we see common sense here, and we propose that the liabilities of pension schemes should be based upon dog food inflation. This is partly because I'm long of dog food manufacturing stocks, and I know what the pension funds will do. But I think that's, frankly, as good as anything else. If you change the benchmark and the guy decides to change the portfolio, he's probably written off a certain amount of value just in doing that, the actual cost of doing it. And I would say to you, talking on this sort of behavioral thing, is it surprising that we all get very cautious and start using more cautious benchmarks after the equity markets have gone down? You ask a psychologist, they would say that's exactly what they expect to happen, just as they would expect you when the market goes up to get more relaxed again. One of the things I did just mention, which I think is very important, this is a chart from James Montier, a former colleague of Ian. It's for the US, stock holding periods, turnover. Now, this is the holding period, so therefore turnover is much higher. It got back to where it was in the 1930s. There is a little bit of justification here in as much as dealing costs are lower than they used to be. But I would say it doesn't justify this. It probably justifies a very small amount of it. But the confidence, the desire to outperform benchmarks, the short-termism, put it all together, you get this. And my contention would be the primary beneficiary of this is, of course, as always, investment banks. So how are we going to fix it? What needs to be done? Sort of looking at it from my sort of contorted point of view. Firstly, I really think it's time that the industry pulled its finger out and got finding out where the cash is coming from in the different assets they own. You know, if you are appointing somebody to manage a portfolio of, I don't know, weather futures or something, then let's get it clear what we're doing here. Are we punting on, or so are we backing somebody to punt on the weather futures? You know, well, let's get it clear. And you, because I have a new product for you, which is called the 330 at Newmarket Fund. Where I will punt on the races at Newmarket, and you know, I have a great high degree of confidence that I can do this well. And you need to know that, not look at a spreadsheet or whatever of my past performance. I think we do have to align expectations. Part of the problem which has lain behind what's happened recently is the fact that I showed you my sort of back of the end envelope calculations of returns, 7 or 8% for equities, 4 and a bit for bonds and so on. You've got to get real on that. It may not be what you want to see, and it certainly ain't as good as it used to be when there was a lot of inflation in the system, though clearly we can argue about the merits and demerits of that. But I think part of the problem has been that the too many people are trying to get back to the old days when you used to make more than what is reasonable to expect. That is very foolish because the markets are in their own strange way quite efficient. And if I offer you 6% from a bond portfolio, then there's a risk in there. There is a risk. And you know, we don't have to be necessarily very clever to work that out, but there certainly is, and to forget that can be fatal. The fees, as I said, take an equity portfolio. If we're going to give away to our friendly investment bank or whatever, 2% in fees, that's 25% of the return gone. Worth bearing in mind. I think the incentive issues are very important. I don't know what chance there is of fixing this. It will be fixed in the short run. The banks and people with the lending practices will change in the short run. But I mean, all history would suggest there'll be a period of great caution, and gradually, as things get better, people will get more relaxed. And to use Chuck Prince's word, we'll all be dancing again. Fix the rear view mirror. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear me. I mentioned the LTCM, selective choice of a period of time that happens to suit your book. Not good, not good. The world is very hard out there. The financial market is peopled, I believe, by intelligent people who put together are there to destroy us. That's what they want to do. And if you start taking risks, you start getting very relaxed and forgetting about the fact that the underlying engine of what you own is not very good, they'll have you in due course. Benchmarking behavior should change. You've just got to measure. I mean, it's tough, but you have got to measure your portfolio managers and your asset allocation and all the rest of it, but it must be done in the context of measurement only. Investment timescale must be expanded. I think just shortening the timescale as clearly as happened, as the turnover chart showed, is unproductive. It's great. I mean, it may be great for some investors, but not for the pension fund and their sort of equity or bond portfolios. And a sense of ownership, I think, is very important. This is not a sort of moral thing, particularly, that you've got to sort of vote and you've got to be terribly concerned about the financial system or the corporate world or whatever. It's about common sense. We're buying assets which generate cash or do not generate cash, and we better understand where that cash or not cash comes from. What will actually happen? Well, there'll be a regulatory expansion and conservatism, clearly. I mean, it's already started. You don't need me to tell you that. based on the recent past, you always correct what just went wrong. Not the future risks. Unfortunate, but that's what we'll do. It will change the shape of risks in future, but it will only partially succeed in what it tries to do. But it is clearly here to stay. Portfolios will become more conservative in a conventional sense. Clearly, people are going to have less equities, more property, bonds, and so on. Hedge funds and private equity, I think, are probably here to stay. I'm sure people will sort of question these asset classes as time goes on, and you know, you can ask me about these things, but I think these assets, you know, methods of dealing with people's cash are here to stay, and rightly so. My own personal view, and I'm not looking at this from your point of view, but looking at it from the corporate point of view, is I don't see why anyone would have a DB fund, a DB pension scheme. I mean, how can I run a PLC when somebody comes along and tells me, oh, sorry guys, we've changed our mind, you thought you had a £5 million surplus, it's actually a £20 million deficit, or vice versa, it doesn't matter. I can't run a company like that, particularly as the regulation and so on effectively brings these changes in the pension fund onto my balance sheet. And if you want a forecast, it would be that clearly these schemes are unsustainable as time over time. They're so big in relation to the PLCs. I mean, in the old days, it was tolerable because they were relatively small compared to the PLCs. The new asset classes, I think, got to be very careful here. There is a lot of unthinking signing up for techniques which may look good with the sort of benefit of recent hindsight, but as always, we need to know what's going to happen in the future. Fees are still, I think, too high. Absolute return investing, buying things because they're going to do well and not owning them when they're not going to do well, that seems to me to be something, a message which people should take to heart. I think there is a certain, our clients certainly are more absolute oriented than they used to be, whether that's encompassed in say the contracts that we have with them or not. The idea that there's a portfolio for all times, this is something which has sort of floated from time to time. You know, if we could only get the asset allocation right, it would be fine. That's rubbish. I mean, it's absolute rubbish. You can backtest and you can have portfolios which meet your goals for a period of time, but the correlations between asset classes do change from time to time. The world changes because the economies change, and you just have to have a different portfolio in different environments. I think if you understand the environment, you'll understand that. One consequence of this is that there is an exception, which is you take the risk down to such a low level, effectively deposits. Even then there's a risk, obviously. But of course, if you do that, you're not talking about the conventional sort of portfolio at all. You're just talking a risk-free type of thing. Ownership and economic-driven investment, fees, vested, just complexity. Ben, one of the things I've learned to my cost is that complexity is bad. On the whole, if you can't understand it, and if it isn't pretty straightforward, sensible thing to do, avoid it. You're getting all this free information, you see, it's fantastic. I think it's information, you probably think it's rubbish. My little fund, I sort of talk about these things and try to sort of apply it a little bit in Fidelity. They kindly said I could do this. It's basically a sort of extension of what I have done with my own modest pot of money. So just thought I'd give you a quick insight into this. It's actually macro driven. It's to do with assessment of different markets. It's obsessed with the economic returns, what the different engines are likely to produce, and it's very much based on long term. I'm not really interested in guessing whether the equity market's going to do better than the bond market over the next 3 months. You know, I mean, toss a coin is probably as good as you probably really should bet. Give me money for the new market rather than that. Cheap, simple, long term is good. Cash income, very important, very important. I'm always very sceptical of sort of great investment ideas which want you to give it cash rather than it give you cash. Seems to me, you know, that's okay on a strictly temporary basis. Past correlations. I mentioned, you know, there is no long-term portfolio. I very much believe this. And unless you're going to lower the risk to almost to the point of deposit account rates, then you are going to have to make decisions of significant extent to change assets occasionally. Not trading, not tactical, but longer-term changes are going to be inevitable. Of course, it is the future correlations between the asset classes that count, not the past ones. And forecasting that's a damn sight more difficult than projecting forward from what's come in the past. I very much discipline myself not to look at the returns on the short-term basis, but we do look at the returns against the benchmark and against cash plus 3.5 over time, just to see how it's gone. And I've set some ranges. They reflect the sort of firm that Fidelity is. It can't be a cash fund. So I've made a maximum of 25% cash, a fair amount of equities, and so on. I don't believe in quarterly looking at portfolios, because that's what everybody else does. And one thing I know about investment is don't do what everybody else does. That's a really silly thing to do. You know, everybody sitting down worrying about the same thing is not going to lead to great decisions. So I used to have this continuous review, which you might say means I don't do anything for a fair while. I won't dwell on this, but one of the problems is that, of course, a lot of the markets correlate more than they used to, and there are quite close correlations, including some of the hedge fund portfolios up there. And the ones that are sort of negatively correlated, there's not many of them. And frankly, as soon as you get an environment where the same universe of investors is punting on commodities as equities, you will find the correlations will tend to move together anyway. So I think it's a tough environment. In the old days, you used to get it that, you know, that some markets, equity market, just within the equity markets, would go up and others would go down. And this meant it was sort of not easy, but it was at least possible to sort of lower the volatility of the total portfolio. It really is not that easy today. So I have to live with a fair amount of volatility, I think, inevitably. Quickly on the world today, I'm overrunning time, nearly there. I do think that the world has changed. It really is very different from the way it used to be. The bulk of the global economic growth is shifting away from the West, something we need to bear in mind. It is important. Doesn't mean you've got to go and buy all the emerging markets and not own the mature markets, because you probably don't need me to tell you that you don't necessarily make more money out of equity markets in rapidly growing economies. Why? Because you have to share the growth with the locals. So when a Chinese company is floated at a massive price and everybody buys it because they want a stake in China, they're sort of paying over the odds for it. But I do think that perhaps a lot of investors still overestimate the risk in some of the emerging markets anyway. I am pretty much in the camp that commodities and materials go in fairly long cycles, and it seems to me that the current shortage of materials is likely to persist for a while. Not forever. So that's very important. But I think the fact that so many of the producers are finding it so difficult to ramp up extra production of metals or oil or whatever means that that is likely to be around for a while. So I want to have that well represented in a portfolio. I believe that the old world, that's us, inflation is picking up modestly. But to my mind, as a sort of interested in longer term and themes and trends, that's not the important thing. The important thing is that the wonderful climate of falling inflation, driving PEs and interest rates and all the rest of it, which we had for 25, 30 years, has, I think, come to an end. And that has big implications for the assets. I mean, it says more you want to own equities, I think, than bonds, unless bonds are conspicuously cheap. And it does, in my book, also suggest that other things being equal, again, the inflation-linked bonds are probably more attractive than the fixed bonds. Equities, I think, are actually not bad value. The problem is that there's a lot of bad stuff going on. And I find it very difficult to see the equity markets making a lot of positive headway until we sorted out the extent of the banking problems, for instance, and the extent of how that's going to spread through the economies and so on. The interesting thing now, the more I've looked at this, and long before I started doing this, I became convinced that the one of the disadvantages of the benchmarking that we typically use, particularly in relation to equities, but actually I think also probably elsewhere as well, is we tend for matters of convenience and because of the way the indices are constructed, we tend to take a geographical approach. How much is going to go in America? How much is going to go in Europe? How much is going to go in emerging markets or the Far East, or however we defend it, and that really defines where your portfolio manager puts the money. I think that we do not give nearly enough credence to the importance of the type of company you own. Coming back to the economics of being a utility in, say, an electric utility in a country which is short of electric power is radically different from the economics of being a retailer. But of course, they both sit side by side in the same index. So in my little fund, I do buy one or two individual shares to try and tilt my fund a little bit in the direction I want to go. So being very keen on utilities and resources companies and infrastructure companies as well, though that's a little bit more difference. On currency, I just throw my arms up in horror. I really have no value added to add that there. And I try to keep myself very humble and admit that I probably know less than I think I do. So far, well, cash plus 3.5 benchmark. And there is the benchmark which I set, a UK-based benchmark for the portfolio underneath that, 25% UK equities and so on. It was my effort 3.5 years ago when we set this up to try and come up where I thought a typical UK pension fund might end up, or something that in that region, to try and see how it went. Vehicles used, ETFs, closed-end funds, stocks to provide the tilt and of cash. And the ETFs, of course, would include commodities or anything else that's available. I'm trying to keep it simple, and it's a relatively small fund. We can't go out and employ someone to buy property directly. So. And since, you know, since it started, it's done quite well against those benchmarks. But I do not look at these. I don't count up where it is, except just occasionally. I'm not going to say, oh my God, the equity market's going down. We've got to sell. We've got to sell, 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 sell. Always after the market's gone down, you feel like that, of course. So we're not going to do that. So my argument would be the markets are having to deal with excesses, which are primarily a function of psychology, human weakness, foolishness, and so on. Not so much with getting the sums wrong. Dealing with these type of issues is really tough because vested interest comes into it, fees comes into it, and my guess is that the losses and the chaos we're currently seeing and have seen will purge some of the problems and improve them, as I said, mitigate them for a while, but I think it won't be permanent, sadly. I wish it were. Conservatism will increase, but again, when the markets do better, it will become less common, less desirable to be conservative, but you will have put in place regulatory hurdles which will offer some sort of control. At least they'll prevent what happened last time from happening again. And I do think the DBDC thing is very important, looking at it from the point of view of the company with the scheme rather than necessarily the investor. So thank you very much for your patience. I hope I haven't caused too much trouble. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Peter and Ian, as well, for that very informative and only slightly depressing overview of the situation we're in at the moment. We do have some time for questions, and there are a couple of roving microphones which will do the round. So if you raise your hand, then hopefully a microphone will miraculously appear in front of you. So do we have the first question, please?
Just a couple of questions for Ian to gauge your bearishness. I mean, do you think we're going to see commercial property sort of hit 90, the levels are hit in sort of the early 90s and similarly corporate debt in the early 2000s? I mean, could you just put it all into a bit of context to maybe lighten the gloom?
Well, I don't pretend to be an expert in any sense on commercial property, so I wouldn't answer that, except I do think that residential property is probably going to get quite bad over the next 6 to 9 months, and historically the two have tended to follow. But and again, I mean, there has been a lot of excess. Everybody's been chasing it, so I think those elements which Peter was talking about there have probably got to come out of that. As far as debt's concerned, I mean, I do think there has been a massive bull market which has been to a large extent misjudged. You know, corporate credit spreads did come down massively over the course of the last few years. They have backed up considerably, but I suspect there are very considerable difficulties ahead. Now where true value is, I have no idea, but I just think reading the runes, if you like, if the US economy does indeed sink beneath the waves, if Europe is adversely affected as well, which I think it will be by similar headwinds and by the knock-on effect, I find it very difficult to see how the corporate credit outlook can't worsen further. further. But I was working until recently with one of the most bearish corporate debt strategists in the business, I think, so he's probably infected me in that regard. But I would be very bearish about corporate debt, commercial property. I wouldn't have such a firm view about.
Question down front here.
You mentioned positive surprises for the US. Do you think that sovereign funds can be counted as such?
Well, obviously, the sovereign funds have been increasingly talked about for the last couple of years, and I mean, over the last few months, they have actually come in as a very significant support for the US banking system. Yes, I mean, I think it will be an important support, but that doesn't actually mean that the problems aren't there to be revealed. You know, I think they'll basically come along as the band-aid and will support things, but I don't think they'll actually remedy the problem per se. But they will make the mending easier. One of the challenges of a central bank faced with a banking system which has overlent and become over-leveraged, as we saw, for example, with the US in the early 90s in the wake of the S&L crisis, how on earth you get it back to health. I mean, one way is to run a very positive yield curve, which, of course, the US has at the moment, and that will help. Another way, of course, is to actually have people to put in fresh capital, and that's exactly what will help in that regard. Whether politically it's acceptable, I mean, if it goes a great deal further, I'm not sure, but that's something to watch very closely. But it's interesting that very few objections seem to have been raised yet, despite it being a US election year.
Question at the back there.
Do you think that the high levels of Chinese inflation that seem to have started is going to have an impact on the rest of the world?
I don't, actually. I mean, a couple of points there. One is, most of the rise in inflation is driven by food inflation. I think the latest figure which came out earlier this week showed food price inflation running at nearly 20% year on year. That's got a very high weight in the Chinese CPI, around 2/5. So that's clearly doing most of the damage. And if you actually X out food price inflation, the actual inflation rate is running still below 1%. So I don't think there's a big problem there. As far as Chinese inflation per se is concerned, I do think one has to recognize there is massive investment in the Chinese economy. And we were familiar with the infrastructure concept because it's quite clear that the Chinese are spending huge amounts of money on the infrastructure, quite understandably. And industry, too, is generally investing very heavily. I think this is a recipe for oversupply rather than inflation. And I'm very skeptical that there will be any leap in China's underlying inflation to any dangerous level because of this, what could be actually subsequently classified as overinvestment, rather similar to what we had in Japan in the late 80s. I also think that wage inflation, although clearly it is picking up, is probably being offset by vast productivity growth, although for the life of me, I haven't been able over the last couple of years to get hold of any reliable Chinese productivity data, so I'm really not sure about that one. As for the rest of the world, I think that's very much a question of what happens to the Chinese renminbi. Now, it has, of course, been appreciating slowly but surely since July 2005. Its pace of increase has accelerated recently, and I certainly wouldn't argue with those that say at some point the Chinese are going to have to let their currency go up a whole lot more for a variety of reasons, and that will clearly be inflationary for the rest of the world. And in that sense, I mean, it is going to be more difficult to hold inflation down in the West because there has been something of a free lunch, if you like, over the last few years. But I don't think it's going to be a massive problem. But it's just something which isn't going to help going forward. And in that regard, I mean, I'm not actually at odds with Peter. I do think the good news on inflation is probably over because I don't think central banks can afford in the mature industrial economies to let inflation go significantly above 2%, because once you get below that level, you're dicing with deflation. And when you've got a very debt-laden system, whether it's corporate debt, whether it's household debt, whether it's banking debt, deflation becomes very, very dangerous. And, you know, sensible inflation targeting banks do actually aim for a positive rate of inflation, you know, 1-3%, something like that. So, you know, I do think the good news of inflation is over, but I don't think what's happening in China is going to have a big effect in pushing up inflation in the West.
Next question. Okay. Whilst people are having a think, that something which occurred to me was that the fact is being referred to as a credit crunch. But given the way that corporate bond spreads seem to have been depressed, to what extent is it more of a return to normal in terms of credit rather than an unusual blowout from normally low levels. That's a question for both of you.
Return to sanity. I think that's right. But I think that the credit crunch aspect, perhaps more, is, and the thing which I think is really worrying, is when one big bank won't lend to another big bank. I mean, I think that's. It's interesting that the Northern Rock has sunk, and as far as we know, there's no problems with his mortgage book. Yeah, it's fine. Absolutely fine. Just they couldn't get the funding. And that, you know, that I think is very dangerous. You might say that the way the housing market is going in the UK, where their mortgages are, the ones they've not sold on, there is problem down the road. So in that sense, people may be sensibly saying, oh, I don't want to lend to them because it may go wrong later. But I mean, superficially at least, the book's fine. Gordon Brown says so, so it must be. He knows.
I think wearing a bit of an American focus hat, I mean, I think the problem with the credit crunch is that people simply aren't willing to lend money to corporates through the capital markets, and we've seen that, and the capital markets had become so important in recent years to A, funding the US corporate sector deficit. I mean, that's basically how they've managed to repay all the equity, which of course helped equity markets upwards by taking on more and more debt onto their balance sheets, and it also, of course, has been a very powerful factor in funding the US current account deficit. You know, and one reason why the dollar has been weakening so sharply hasn't just been anticipation of further Fed rate cuts, it's also been the fact people haven't fancied buying the debt, which they were previously buying in large volume. I think the other aspect is just bank lending behaviour. You know, banks have been falling over themselves to lend money both in the UK and elsewhere to corporates and to households. If they become chary, clearly that can actually be a problem for good companies that perhaps ought to have the money. But, you know, as I think Peter would agree, things tend to move in cycles. You have excess and then you have contraction. And if you think back again to the early 90s, you did have a period when banks were being very, very reluctant to lend money, and that was definitely an impediment to economic growth.
Question over here.
Paul, just following on from your question, I think the interesting thing about the credit contraction is just the amount of capital that's been wiped out of the banks, and that's, I think, the key to why we're seeing all the problems at the moment on the lending side. And on our numbers, there's probably going to be about $180 billion of assets wiped out of the book value, which is somewhere between 15 and 20% of the typical bank in Europe and the US. And with some banks obviously going to be writing off much more than that, probably about, for example, Merrill Lynch has already written off about half of its book value. And it's in this context of a credit contraction, you know, we would see the likelihood of a recession as a certainty in the US, because you always get recession when there's a credit contraction, no matter how much you cut interest rates. If banks don't want to lend, then they're not going to lend. Last week, we saw an amazing situation where a municipal in the States, in New York, was trying to borrow, and there's a very high-quality credit, and was only able to lend at 20% because people like Goldman Sachs simply weren't able to take that debt on anymore. They're simply up to the gills in debt. The question I wanted to pass on was just on some of the tail risks that we see at the moment. I think the first is in the credit insurers, where we see a very high probability that at least two of them will go bust. The first one will probably be ACA this month, but MBI and AmBank, the big ones, are certainly in deep trouble. And that seems to be a substantial and worrying problem coming. The second one is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, again, two enormous institutions. And Freddie Mac in particular seems also to have been affected by the subprime crisis. And we're seeing numbers that maybe 30-40% of its book value will get wiped out over the next year. And the third one is related to the property question. In the UK, it does feel a lot of the comments we're getting are that the banks and the insurers in the UK may come under increasing stress this year. The banks, because their capital ratios are very low compared to US banks, the UK banks are. But on the insurers on the commercial property side may be the left field risk for this year, because of commercial property exposure in the insurance side is often multiples of the book value. So a fall, we see the same conditions as the early 90s in place in the commercial property. And this could have severe impacts on book value. But I'd just be interested on those left, if you like, the tail risks questions of credit insurers or Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and UK property insurance risk.
I mean, it seems to me the risk is that things are going to get a lot worse, if only because everybody else seems to have taken too much for granted, and I don't see why they shouldn't have done. But I mean, I have no specialist knowledge, but I mean, you can come up with a bearish litany of factors. And I mean, if you read the FT, which I'm sure you do, and you see the Martin Wolf column today, he quotes Rubini, who of course has been a bear for a long time, who makes an almost nauseating list of factors of things that could go wrong, and they do include a couple of things you cited there. I mean, I think that's perfectly plausible. But if that does happen, I mean, I'm convinced that the Federal Reserve will move extremely aggressively, as will the government, to do something about it, because the US well knows what can happen if the banking system does start to go down. I mean, the consequences historically have been so poor. And, you know, the big lesson of the 1930s was don't do bad policy. If you do bad policy, you're likely to end up with an economic disaster. So, you know, it could be that we're all absolutely taken aback by quite how extreme the policy response is, as I admitted I had been in January this year.
Just on, again, like Ian, I have no sort of specialist knowledge of this, but, you know, for what it's worth, my experience is that on these occasions, things do tend to all go wrong. You know, the wheels come off. And the stock market, I didn't want to give it too much of an impression of being incredibly negative about the stock market or the markets generally, because clearly the question from the market's point of view is, when do we identify with some certainty the extent of the damage, however bad it may be? In the past, that plus a change in monetary policy has been what tends to sort of turn the stock market round. And to be honest, I just don't know. And the markets clearly have taken on a lot of bad news. I mean, there are very low expectations. And I thought it was interesting with the results out from Barclays Bank a couple of days ago. You could just see the share price reacting to the two points of view. You know, oh, it's going to get worse. Oh, my goodness me. You know, right off the lot, they put a list of their different exposures here. You know, right off the whole damn lot. And on the other hand, the fact that, oh, my goodness me, you know, maybe we're getting through this. And then you have this wonderful banking climate, of course, comes out for those who survive, of the nice favorable yield curve, the conservatism, hitting a sort of new, very lean, to put it kindly, balance sheet. And then you could get a sort of change. For what it's worth, I did a sort of back of the envelope. I'm very good on the back of an envelope. Must be because I get too many letters. Calculation. And on the whole, stock markets tend to turn up in the middle of the recession. Problem, you never know when you're in the middle of the recession. See, it's sort of not good. But on this basis, sort of going along a bit with it, what Ian said about, has the recession in the US started or not? I mean, maybe it has just started, maybe not. It would suggest, you know, on that sort of very basic sort of rule of thumb, it would be a bit early to say the markets are at their lows and have got a grasp on it. Only thing that worries me about dismissing that out of hand is that I'm aware that in today's markets, information travels very fast. People work things out very fast. Market pricing, a lot of the assets gets out and into the real world, you know, the situation very quickly. And maybe things might bottom out quicker. Against the bottoming out message, I think, would be the fact that actually the markets haven't fallen very far. I mean, I showed you that chart of since 2000. I mean, okay, we're not at the new highs, but I think we're about 15% off the peak in Wall Street and London. And that, given the biggest banking crisis that we've had since, you know, it perhaps might seem modest. But then there's the people who are going to come in and buy the equity and will help out. So I don't know, but, you know, this is sort of the way I look at it.
Good question at the back there.
I agree with most of what Pete Holland said. Well done. But I'd like to take it a bit further, much further. And really, this is a hobby horse of mine. I've goaded the actuaries to take more investment strategy on board, not calculation, not risk management, not portfolio allocation, but actually get down to the business of strategy. And you touched on this very well. And in the dot-com boom up to 2000, why weren't all the actuaries saying, get out? It was crazy. Yields were crazy. That was the time to get into bonds. And of course, then you have the flats, regulators, and I'm afraid a lot of consulting actors as well, advise insurance companies and pension funds to get out of equities, go into bonds, at completely the wrong time. In 2002 to 2005, that was the time to get back into equities. It's a strategy game, and the allocations ought to vary according to the economy, portfolio, type of liabilities. But please, would professional investment managers take heed, as well as the equities? Because they are troubled if they take a contrary view, and most of these views have to be contrary to the succession. They take a contrary view and they lose funds under management because they're too early getting out. And what is more, they lose their jobs. But actually, surely the insurance companies and rising pension funds are in a longer term position to say, well, money lost 10%. We got out 24-50%, we'll get back in. It's a strategy game. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just quickly add on to that? I mean, I think that's nice to hear someone say that, and I don't obviously totally agree. It is interesting that I mentioned the benchmarking, and that's the first thing. As soon as you give me a benchmark which has no cash in it, cash becomes a risk. Now, my Octopus fund, I mean, one of the rules there is we do measure the benchmark, but frankly, if I underperform the benchmark, isn't going to bother me. I mean, I'm going to look whether we've got any cash at the end. That seems to me to be what I'm doing. But, you know, that isn't the way that your portfolio manager, your fund management firm is being briefed. It isn't the way he's being rewarded. Come back to this fact that equities halve in price and you do a bit better and consider you've outperformed the benchmark and it's a great, great result. You know, that's not good enough for me. I'm not doing that with my money, you know. They can do that if they really insist upon doing it. But we've got to get together, and you have got to incentivize us. I'm talking to you assuming you're investment consultants. You've got to incentivize us to do the right thing. You've somehow or other got to measure us. But you've also got to accept that there may be times when we're going to underperform this benchmark or some of the benchmarks you've constructed. And I actually don't have a sort of simple answer to this. It's pretty easy for me to say, well, it doesn't bother me because Mrs. Holland won't kick me out for this. I mean, she might be kicking me out for something else, but she won't kick me out for underperforming the benchmark. But, you know, it is different for Fidelity. But this is not a statistical issue, it's not an economic issue, it's a motivational, behavioral issue.